Hey, this is John Matthews, Director of Psalms, and you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader, hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 29 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast about awesome things you can find on iTunes or your fancy podcast apps on the fancy phones. It's the future. No excuse why you can't find the Dan and Travis Show. We're also a proud part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture. Some really amazing and fascinating podcasts over there at chronicrift.com, and we're very happy to be appearing with them. I want to thank everybody for tweeting, downloading, sharing, listening to last week's episode with Crystal House, which was, I'd like to think I'm the only podcast out there that's done an episode so far on online editing and the study of UFOs. So we'll see. If I'm not, don't ruin my dreams. I'm very proud to welcome to the show today an artist of multimediums. Really is, like a lot of guests we've had on, a real jack of all trades. And we're going to talk about how sometimes it's not just one thing you do, but a combination of skills that create the artist or filmmaker. He's working on a new short film right now, and short films are very much a big discussion topic in the world of screenwriting and for screenwriters to get their name out there and get noticed. It's a good idea to get some money together and make a short. So we'll talk about all that as well. But I'm very happy to welcome to the show Kyle C. Mumford. Kyle, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Oh, it's fantastic. So let's just start with Jamie and Jonathan, which is a short film. You are doing an Indiegogo campaign. We'll talk about that as well. But tell us about this movie and what it's all about and how it's coming to be.
Well, sure. The short film is about is pretty much a comedic and heartwarming tale of a failed writer who gets a second chance to be somebody when he meets his estranged young son and is hired to drive him, sadly, to a funeral. It sounds very dark, but at the same time, it's a very enlightening tale of second chances and bonding between father and son.
Now, is this something you wrote yourself or were you hired to direct it by somebody else?
No, this is something I wrote myself. I base it on a lot of experiences I had with family members and my father as well.
Interesting. So I know you don't want to get too much into the twists and turns, but where it says based on the experiences, but it's an interesting thing to say, okay, it's about a funeral, it's about estrangement, and you know, especially between family members, that could be a very painful thing. But at the same time, he says very lighthearted and funny.
Well, the thing about it is that, you know, you think about reality and there's so many things that are tragic in our lives. But when you really start to dig into it, there's so many comedic things that happen to us that, I mean, really when that goes on and it becomes more real. You know, there's so many things that are just so tragic, and at certain times, there's something that comedic that happens out of nowhere. And to me, that makes a story very real. And that's what I'm trying to really do here is this kid who doesn't want to go to a funeral and who a man who's given a second chance to be somebody who's trying to get to the kid to the funeral to be responsible for the first time in his life. And these two butt heads, but at the same time, they create this unique bond. And I think in that lies comedy, which is, you know, tragedy to me is always blanketed by comedy, which I really wanted to show.
Well, I also think that from a, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist by any stretch, but just observationally, I would suggest that we as people, comedy, laughter, and joy is our first, maybe not our first, but our best medicine against tragedy.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And I think sometimes, and I'm not trying to sound like that guy who hates network notes or anything. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But sometimes I think there's a fear of when you're making a drama, there's a fear of putting jokes in because some people might think, oh, no, you're going to undercut the drama. But you're actually not. You're actually enhancing the drama, I think, quite a bit.
Oh my gosh, yeah, because when you write, I mean, you gotta really, it's a fine line to walk between comedy and drama, and you don't want to lean too far on each side. And so you really gotta find the balance with the characters, and that's why this is such a character piece, because it's really them who's gonna be able to show an even balance of the drama and comedy, and it makes it more real.
Is this a subject matter, or not subject matter, but is that a genre you like to explore writing? Is this what you would consider yourself mainly as a drama writer?
I mean, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily drama writer, but in a sense, I do like dark comedy or dramedies. That's more what I like to prefer. I mean, I love thrillers, I love mysteries and horrors, but dramedies are really what I draw from because it's, like I just said, I'm like, you know, repeating myself, but it's very real to me. It makes sense. It's just real life. It's what happens to us.
Well, it's funny. I'm on a bit of this podcast is somewhat is turning into a bit of a crusade for me. One of the things, and I know we'll talk about directing actors and stuff, and maybe this is a good segue, I love actor interviews, and I think actors present things in a philosophy that I think a lot of writers need to listen to. One, because they're going to be the people bringing our thing to life, our lines, our dialogue. You know, they're going to inhabit it, so we should listen to a lot of what they think. But actors are always talking about the truth of a character. You know what I mean? Like, and it's not the ultimate truth of life, but the truth of that character and what that's driving to. And I think that's kind of – that's what I'm sort of hearing when you talk about what's being real, which is like it's being authentic and being the truth of this thing. If you're going to write – you know, this character has abandoned his son. There's a truth in that. you know, whatever his motivations or justifications, however he rationalized in his mind, he was not there for a long time.
And the thing about it is you find out the reason why he did it is because he did it for a career that ended up not taking off. And when that happened, I mean, you know, a lot of us bank on certain things and sacrifice, I don't want to say sacrifice, but they abandon certain things in our lives for a career that we don't know is going to take off. And the ironic thing about this character, Jamie, who leaves his son and the girl he once was with, is because he wants to be a writer. But yet again, the funny, ironic thing is that he's dyslexic, which is I kind of riffed on myself because I am a dyslexic writer. And it's very, I don't know, there's a lot to it, which I find.
That's a challenging thing.
Oh yeah.
If you don't mind, can I ask you to go into that a little bit? Because you're not the first dyslexic writer I've met, and I know that sometimes it's different software, but it's not that simple. I mean, I'm not dyslexic, so it's hard for me to sort of understand or relate.
Well, you know, being dyslexic is like, it's people think, oh, you see things backwards, you see this, and it's not the case. It's really communication to the brain, the paper or what you're reading. I cannot describe it, but it's a symptom where you're going to have it. I mean, the best way to do it is take your time. I mean, for me as a writer, I was told when I was younger that I would not, I'm not a good writer and I never will be. But what really drove me was the idea of, you know, my ideas were really good. I believed enough in my ideas. Yeah. So I would just take practice in rewriting it and take my time. So I would be slower than a normal writer. But I knew if I worked hard enough and worked at a certain segment of the story longer than usually would take a normal person to do it, I would eventually get it. And you can't give up on it. If anybody out there is dyslexic, you have the same skills that anybody else has. You just, you know, it's going to take you longer, and you just have to have the patience for that.
Something I forget. I'm a lifelong wrestling fan, and Vince McMahon is dyslexic.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I mean, he's running a multi-billion-dollar company for 30 years, so it's not something. It's an interesting thing because I think, a lot of men suffer from dyslexia. I think more than women. I may be wrong about that, but I think I read that somewhere that it's a very sort of male thing. And I heard it described another time, too, and quite a few friends of mine are dyslexic, and I've heard it sort of described in some cases as, and I may be wrong about this, so jump in, is like whenever we're reading or digesting information, the mind makes choices, and sometimes with dyslexia, it's almost too many choices presented at once.
Yeah,
is the way I sort of heard it described, and that kind of made a lot of sense to me, as far as like, oh, that's what it is, because it's not like you can't read. It's not like you can't write. That's wrong to say. I don't think it, and I've heard a lot of people say, no, it's not a disability. It's more of a condition. Does that all make sense?
It is very true. It is more of a condition. It's different for every person, whoever has it, because it just, you know, the funny thing about it is you're right with most people who have it are much more visionaries.
Yeah.
See things visually. That's how they connect more so in learning and how I connected when I was learning in school and everything like that. And that's it took me a while to realize how to go around certain things. But what a lot of what you said is true.
But would you say, though, it's been an aid to you? Because you're a director. If you pull, we're going to post your IMDb on the thing, and you've got just – you just do everything. I mean, you're a director, you're a cinematographer, you've done stuff. You've done stuff in visual effects. Has that really been an aid to you, or is that just sort of you are a visually minded person? You that's the medium you respond to.
Well, you know, I mean, working a lot of different positions really does help. You know, if you look at a lot of editors in the industry, the interesting thing about them is that they know how to tell a story probably better than a cinematographer. I mean, a lot of cinematographers are not going to kill me, but it's just one of those things that they visually know how to piece a story together in an edit, which there's a lot to it. You know, cinematography, the visuals. You know, you got to remember with filmmaking, there's so many elements that make a story. It's just not a one-man band all the time. So working in those different facets of the industry actually helps you communicate to those, if you're running your own project, how to run things easier. Because there's certain people out there who just, you know, they never were in the shoes of an editor, cinematographer, you know, grip, background even, actor, writer. There's certain things that you have to communicate, and the more you do different jobs, the easier it is to communicate when you're the top guy.
Because you know the shorthand, and you know the problems and the challenges and the thought process of that position. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, for people, being a grip is one of the hardest jobs I've ever seen.
I mean, the greatest.
It's so hard. They are some of the many unsung heroes out there in the world of TV and film. It's incredible. Like myself, you're from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
When you made the decision, you know, on the beautiful shores of Asbury Park, looking across the Atlantic Ocean, and you decided you were going to get in the business, be in entertainment. What was it you wanted to be? Like you now do a lot of different positions, but when you were 10, were you like, I want to be a director, I want to be a writer, I want to be an editor? I mean, you said before somebody told you couldn't be a writer. Boy, that's terrible. And yeah. Good for you for showing them wrong. That's the best thing to do. What was that experience like? What was your decision making process as far as like, I want to get in the business and I want to be blank?
You know what? It changed over the years. I'm going to be honest with you. It changed over the years, and just the way of really, I just wanted to be an artist in the beginning. An artist, I didn't know what it was, but I fell in love with stories, and I think the first thing that clinked to me was acting.
Mm-hmm.
But then it changed to directing and writing. As I went through my high school years and got into college, I went to School of Visual Arts for directing and writing. Still to this day, I can't really decide because I want to do a lot. Not spread myself thin a lot, but really – there's so many different hats I really enjoy to wear because, you know, I might get tired of one thing and, you know, want to move to the next.
Right.
And it's, that's what I, surprisingly, back then, I still think the same way.
Well, I think one of the things about it, I always hate it when somebody says you can't write. I mean, everybody, I think if you have something to say, you can write. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be John Irving or, you know, Robert Towne, but like if you have something to say, you can write. And that really is what drives, I think, a lot of us.
Mm-hmm. A lot. Now I'm forgetting the screenwriter, but I had a great conversation with a wonderful screenwriter at one point. But we were chatting at a party, and I walked right up to him. And I said, you know, I really appreciate your writing. And I'm a dyslexic writer. I really appreciate your writing. And he said, you know what, Kyle? Those who are different have something to say. Mm-hmm. And we are the ones that really will shine. And to me, that just struck me. It really did, that no matter what, how hard I, you know, if I worked hard enough, I will get to where I need to be. No matter what a dick said or like years ago, or whatever said to me, you know, you won't be this or you won't be that. It really got to me.
I totally agree with you. And it's one of those things where it sounds like a cliche, but you know, I've been in the business now for 12 years ish, almost 13. And, truly no one is there's, I think some people like imagine Hollywood as this thing and there's somebody there, like a, whether it be a Harvey Weinstein or, whatever power broker it is who's going to turn around one day and say, you are banned from this place and you're never allowed back. And it just doesn't work like that. Quite frankly, the only person who truly can stop you is you.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've learned. Now, that's almost a more cynical, glasses half full way, half empty way to look at it. But like no one in the world is going to stop you but you. And if you have something to say, if you're passionate about it, if you believe in what you're saying, and if you're willing to put in what you were describing before, the work.
Yeah.
There's really no excuse. But... And a lot of people that will hear that, we all have heard it, quite frankly. I think everybody has heard somebody say, you can't do it.
Yeah.
Because people who can't do it want to turn around and say to somebody, well, you can't do it either, so you're going to stay down here with me.
Yeah.
And that sticks with a lot of people. And some people listen and say, yeah, you're right, I can't do it. What was it about you that made you say, no, I can do it? You know, to hell with you. I'm gonna do it anyway, because that's sometimes a very scary endeavor.
I've always been told that because, I mean, I have other disabilities like Tourette's and, you know, my parents were told that when I was younger that I wouldn't amount to much by certain, I guess, semi-psychologists or whatever. But I just, you know, I had the will, the desire, because I believed in my ideas that were good enough. No matter how much I was put down, the ideas or the collaboration I'll be working with somebody – the inspiration we feed off each other. That's what's so good about the indie world is that you meet somebody, you meet an actor. The lead in this short film, my buddy Dan, Daniel Christian, he's such a moving person that we clicked and we wanted to work together for a while. And my producer, Carly McGinnis, is so. You meet people like that, and that's what inspires you to do better. Really, it brings it drive. It drives you even more.
Yeah, and you need – you know, it's funny that I love – I've been very fortunate and blessed to work with some super talented people, many of whom have been on the podcast and are going to be more who are coming.
Awesome.
And it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it's I don't know how much of a sports fan you are, but like if you get to play with Tom Brady – you know, or you get to be coached by Rex Ryan, or you get to be on the Yankees, you are just going to kick ass, and it is just, you just excel at that excellence. There's something really exciting about it, you know, being around excellence and being around other talents, because almost on a selfish level, you want to impress them and be like, well, hey, look, you know, look what I can do too, and let's go rock and roll and kick some ass together.
Oh, yeah.
Now, let's talk about, so... But again, like you were, would you describe yourself like as you've gone on your journey? Let's talk a little bit about your journey here of like discovering yourself as a director. And you've done a lot of editing too as well.
Yeah, a lot.
Is that what you've done like maybe the most of?
Oh yeah, most definitely. I mean, that's been probably half or more than half of my work or what I do in the industry is post-production.
Now, how helpful is that to see what you need and what you don't need on set? Like, how much has editing helped you as a director?
You know, pretty much what it does is it helps you know what you're looking, what you want to get,
right.
The mood, the look, because you know when you're going to cut and when you're going to start from your clip and when you're going to end. So pretty much you know what segment of the take you're going to have. And in your head, you're already editing it. The scene, and it allows you to do that very easily. You know what's usable, what's not usable. An actor might do something that is you never noticed before, and you say, you know what? I'm going to take that little snippet and I'm going to cut it with the take we had before, and it will work out perfect. That's what I get a lot from. You get a lot from it.
Yeah, there's a great engineering aspect to it too. But it, going back to the other thing of. You know, it's true with editing. You have to have, though, story is still going to be the king to determine those cuts.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to... It's funny, some editors who've directed have told me that they will actually have a much shorter, maybe not shorter, what's the word I'm looking for, but they'll shoot less because they know exactly what they need. Have you found that to be true?
Some of it, yeah. I mean, some stuff I would say that's half and half, because some stuff you don't really, you want to get more material just in case to be safety-wise.
Sure. Sure.
But also, if you know what you're doing as a director and you really know the scene well enough, you're going to know what you want, and you're going to shoot it, and you're going to take what you were there to do. So it's half and half.
What would you be able to define that for me? If you know what you're doing as a director, how would you describe the director's job and what it is a director actually does? I know, easy, right? Real easy question.
Yeah, well, yeah. it there's so much to it. The director really is the one who, the top guy who makes all the choices that are, in the end, really necessary. You are the one who decides, all the way from casting to cinematography to editing. You are the one who controls it all. And really, it's really, you have to have all those elements in your head going on when you're directing the actor, which is one of the most important things. How it's going to read on screen, and how the story that you have, the script, if it's, you know, if you're actually making that come to life, is the action that's happening in front of camera working for the story you're trying to tell? And all a director has to do, really, is make the decisions that he feels is right,
mm-hmm.
that proves justice to the story. I mean, I can go on about what a director's job is, but I mean, everybody has their own definition.
Sure.
And I think that's what makes it so unique as a director, because your own definition is your own style and, you know, how you choose to tell your story. That's pretty much it.
What are your solutions for when you're watching a take, and for whatever reason, whether it be the performance, whether it be whatever the reason, what's your solution when you're watching that take and everything is going wrong, and the story, and you got to almost like walk in and, you know, you say cut, and you walk in and be like, all right, I got to fix this.
You talk to your team.
Yeah.
If it's your cinematography, you talk to your cinematographer. If it's your actor, which is, you know, most of the cases, you really got to talk about where the character is coming from.
Mm.
What is he doing in the scene? What is his motivation? What is his need? And is it authentic to what the script and what the story is suggesting that he does? And if it's not coming across, you really have to be responsible as a director to make sure it does come across. And if it takes time, then, I mean, it's going to drive your AD, your assistant director, nuts. But at the same time, you really got to make sure everything's perfect. Or else you're going to go back and do more reshoots or, you know, yeah.
Now, Jamie and Jonathan, you've written. And now, have you guys started shooting yet or?
Oh, no. Yeah, the whole thing is we shot already, and we are doing a crowdfund to finish the film in post-production to PR to film festivals to color correction, you know, sound mix. It all costs a lot to finish. But we shot pretty much Jamie and Jonathan. It's a great, yeah. It was just a really great experience, especially working with my two main actors.
Now, just real quick, like, how have you found? Have you directed other stuff that other people have written, and or? How much easier / better, or is it harder to direct stuff that you have written?
I've actually never directed something that I haven't written, which
okay.
I've always wanted to, because it would be a fresh new perspective.
Sure.
I've always directed stuff that's been my own
mm-hmm.
for a long time now. And I've always wanted to do that, to take somebody else's, you know, literature and, you know, put it on screen.
No, absolutely. And, but have you also ever run into the case here? And again, like I talked at the top of the show, that shorts is now something that's entering the screenwriting lexicon pretty aggressively. You know, we're hearing a lot of chatter, a lot of buzz, a lot of writers are talking about, shoot, I can't get management representation, can't get noticed. We'll make a short, try to get on festivals, things of that nature.
It's a huge tool. It's a huge tool that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. And it shows too that you're for real, and that you can write something, that you can do things. You know what I mean? It definitely gives you a lot of credibility, and it gives you a chance to really showcase your voice. But have you found that? Because there can be a lot of times where writers and directors disagree about certain character things and certain this direction. No, this person should be like this, etc., etc. Have you found in your directing experiences, because this is now like your sixth or seventh short that you've made?
Yeah, I've made a good amount.
You've made quite a few. Okay, so you've got a pretty pretty extensive resume of making stuff here and directing your writing. Have you found that you've disagreed with the writer who's yourself? Like you get on set and you start thinking, you're like, oh my God, that's right, this is all wrong. I need to do it like this, or I need to change it like that.
Yeah, well, I have a really good story for you.
Please.
When I went to School of Visual Arts, and my thesis film was actually a feature length movie called His Naked Mind. Mm-hmm. And in that world of undergrad, they were very against feature films being made. And of course, me being me, I said, well, you know, it could be done.
Yeah.
And I went out and I wrote something. And I shot it. And when I got to post-production, I realized that I should have spent more time on the script. And mm-hmm. I didn't. So a lot of the changes that the film ended up being, and the film did very well at the school, ended up getting a lot of awards, which is great. But a lot of the stuff I did was a Superman edit, a Superman save with my editing to correct the story. And sometimes you think you have it on the script, and you go to shoot it, and you go, wow, this does not make sense at all.
Right.
I think it was Woody Allen who said something where, when you're writing a script, you think it's the next Citizen Kane, you think it's amazing. When you actually get to shooting, it's like, wow, this must be the most god-awful piece of shit the world has ever seen. But, I think that taught me a big lesson of to be 100% sure of what you're writing is what you want. And, I mean, that... for years, I've always, for years afterwards, I've always, kept at the heart.
No, outstanding. And, something else we should talk about is, and it's at the top of your, filmography in IMDb is, a very overlooked part of filmmaking and production and how important it is. And because it's usually done really well and you don't notice it, and that's what you shouldn't notice it. You just enjoy it. And that's sound. And you've done a lot of work in the world of sound.
Yeah.
And how has that sort of influenced you, and how has that been able to teach you as a director? Because I think a lot of times we don't always think of that.
Well,
go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just going to say is pretty much in a nutshell, good audio could save bad video, but good video cannot save bad audio.
Wow, that's a good one.
Sound is really key to a lot of things. Really, if it's a horror movie scene, obviously sound is very unique. It really brings you into the environment. It's the one who completes the environment that you are allowing yourself to fall into this film. That doesn't make any sense, sorry. But what I'm trying to say is that it allows you to really... commit yourself as an audience member 100% into the scene by the sound. You're right there.
Going back to Jamie and Jonathan for a second, we tend to bounce around on the show a little bit. This is some heady stuff, you know what I mean? And it's a good example, I think, of what you can do in a short. And I think I've always been sort of intimidated actually by the short form. I'm developing a short right now myself to hopefully shoot in 2016.
Oh,
and,
awesome.
It's actually kind of like been an interesting thing to explore the idea of 20, 30 pages. This is a pretty heady topic you're playing with. Like you said, you've introduced some comedic elements and things like that.
Oh, God, yeah, it is.
And I've not seen His Naked Mind, but looking at it, you're dealing with some heady stuff there as well. You know, this is pretty intense choices. But
yeah,
something I've noticed as a writer, like, I think the more you do this stuff, the more you write, the more you direct, the more you just get on with your craft and get on with your trade, the more you want to tackle more difficult things. And is Jamie and Jonathan an example of, like, you developing as a writer? Like, would you have been able to write this story 5, 10 years ago?
No. Oh, God, no. I think a lot of it comes from experiencing life.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing about writing is you only get better as you get older because you experience things as an adult that you're able to add into a film script that you witness, that you're able to know that fine line of, you know, when it comes to that kind of topic very well.
The a kind of quick follow-up to that is another buzzword that a lot of aspiring screenwriters hear a lot, and a lot of things that you'll find on lectures and other podcasts and things. And I like to talk about it as well because I'm like, even still, you know, I've been writing scripts for, like, God almighty, 25 years now, but, like, finding your voice, quote-unquote, you know, how, like, do you feel you found, it seems like you've got a firm handle with the stuff you're writing and directing, a firm handle on your voice, or have you, and how did you find it, you know, how did you find that, and it's always so hard for me, because, like, the word voice, I'm almost sort of like, well, I'm not sure exactly what that means. you know what I mean?
And you never know,
it's basically just the stories you want to tell. How did you find that voice for yourself?
By living, by really experiencing things. Like I just said, it just, you know, when it comes to love life, when it comes to relationships with parents, as you get older, you really see the gray areas that people are so, where they're so vulnerable, where they're so real. And I think what I really wanted to describe, and actually, you know, the funny thing is, I think what makes Lian Dunham so successful is that she was able to pinpoint that right away.
Yeah.
Of how, you know, people in their 20s live, what they talk, what they're really thinking in sex too. It's really being 100% authentic to what you're really trying to say, what you really see. And, you know, being authentic is very hard because you're afraid to offend people. You're afraid to hurt somebody. And that's what's really key. I mean, that really is.
I quite agree with you. And I think that's true. I think people will see through. Let me throw this one at you. Like, I think sometimes people are afraid to fail, and that's a big mistake. Or people are afraid to make a mistake. Or people are afraid, well, what if I make a bad movie? Like, listen, there's, I sat at lunch with a bunch of editors one time, and if they're listening, they know who they are. I literally sat at lunch where all these editors are talking about how bad a movie Casablanca was.
Yeah.
And I was just sitting there horrified because I'm like, this is one of the great movies ever made. And like, and they're good guys. I like these guys. I liked working with them. They're great dudes, but I could not believe what I was hearing. Somebody out there is going to think your movie's bad. Don't worry about that. No, you cannot change that. But I think it would be worse to make something that's kind of either dishonest or, I don't want to use the word safe, but sort of, I think that's what people mean sometimes when they say cheesy. They're like, well, I'm not buying that. That's bullshit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can watch a lot of romantic comedies that are not cheesy. I don't mean to pick on that genre, but you know what I mean.
You know, you have to be authentic. You have to be real. And if you have somebody who doesn't like your work and they get really pissed off, well, guess what? You made him pissed off. You affected him in some way. You know, I mean, it just, you don't want to be fake. You really don't. And I totally agree with you on that one.
Well, the other thing too, that and what's important about that is sometimes we've heard this, you know, we've been to the Austin Film Festival several times and we've heard this. I've heard this from other aspiring writers and et cetera, where somebody says, you know, well, where somebody will be told, you know, like, how do I compete with so-and-so? How can I compete with, you know, like with all these people writing dramas and writing things and all that? And the answer is usually, well, make sure the script that you turn in is something that only you would write. And then the next question is, well, how do I do that? And I think your answer is the best, which is the truth. Be real, be authentic, be the thing. You and I both grew up in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm about, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm not going to say how much. But we both grew up in similar neighborhoods. I grew up in Point Pleasant.
Oh, wonderful.
And you grew up in near Asbury Park, it looks like.
Yeah, on the outskirts of Asbury Park, good old Asbury.
And you and I will have similar sort of, you know, backgrounds. But if you and I were to write a movie about whatever subject, it would be two totally different movies.
Hmm.
Or even if you and I both wrote an Asbury Park screenplay, it would be two totally different Asbury Park screenplays. Because, you know, we found our voice and we know how to make it. I know how to make it a Tim Davis script, and you know how to make it a Kyle Mumford script, and that's very important.
Yeah.
That's how you stand out.
It is. I mean, you know, a lot of people, the thing is that there's so many writers out there, there's so many filmmakers out there, but, you know, and people get discouraged easily. They say, hey, you know, there's so many, what's the point? But really what it is that it's what you have to offer, your voice, what you have to say that makes you stand out. Makes you different. I mean, yeah, you could say me being dyslexic is, you know, I guess a little bit different. But, I mean, it's only one thing that just drives me to just do as well. There's a lot of things in – I love writing about blue-collar people. Yeah. That's how I grew up. I love writing about things that are real and, you know, what people face, the challenges that these middle-class people – that people in the middle class face. And to me, that's where I stand. That's where I find my stories a lot of the times, and even love relationships too.
Well, I'm a huge mark for Joseph Campbell, and you know I think he sort of solidified in many ways the meaning of life with follow your bliss, and that's what we're doing. You know what I mean? We're following our bliss, and we're following and telling the stories that we absolutely want to tell. And I think, and you know, one of my previous guests, Dan Mason, talked about this when he took a writing class. And this is a very important thing to get over, which is, and I'm curious to hear your take on it, Kyle, is, well, why should I tell a story? Why would anybody care about what I have to say? Because your story is, even though we're talking about individual voices, the story itself, there is going to be somebody out there waiting to hear that story.
Yeah. I mean, look, you have an idea. And if you believe it's good enough, that's what drove me.
Yeah.
You got to work on it. You know, the first draft is not going to be perfect, but if you keep working on it, something you're gonna find a diamond out of that pile of coal. You're really gonna rough it out, and you're gonna find something really unique.
No, absolutely right. And I think people will the thing for us is, especially I think it's scary for first time writers and aspiring writers who are like, oh my god, who's gonna. You know, again, a lot of folks are scared about being rejected or if it's not good or if it's bad. And it's hard for us to see that there's people out there. There will be people who you've never met, who you know nothing about, who live in other states across the country, who will be able to watch Jamie and Jonathan and go, oh my God, I can totally relate to these two people.
That's the beauty of film. Okay, because I, as an artist, one thing I say is that art is pretty much an act of giving. You know, yeah, there's a selfish part because all artists are selfish. They care about their vision. But it is a part of giving. And the one thing I loved, and I made a documentary called Mumford's Law based on my family. And the greatest gift I ever got back was being able to explore that film and share it and screen it. And then people going, wow. And they were touched by it. And people who fall into stories that really move them, they take something from it, and they apply it to their own lives. And that's what really good art is to me. It really affects an audience to where they – and impacts them in their own lives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it's a little, you know, out there kind of theory, but I mean it's just something I believed in.
No, it's not. See, that's the thing. I think it's – you know, I know what you mean when you say it's an out there kind of theory, but it's – It's not. I mean, this is a
very poetic.
Yeah, but that's what we're doing. I mean, that's the world we live in, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I'm primarily a screenwriter. You know, I'd like to direct more, but I've found that my primary skill is as a screenwriter. And even if I get a chance to direct this short, I will probably have somebody like almost a co-director or a really, really good first AD to be like, dude, what am I not thinking of? Or, madame, what am I not thinking of? Mm-hmm. And but I'm primarily a screenwriter, and it's a remarkable thing to how we move words together and string words together on a page can absolutely change somebody's life. And I don't mean that in a grand way, but it's just a really cool thing. And that you can write stuff on a page, and somebody you will never meet across the world will read it and go, this is really, really important, or this is really cool, or this is really funny. You know, this is really, you know, I kind of really agree with you too. I'm repeating what we were talking about before with the whole idea of laughter and tragedy, because I've seen movies where like people are crying all the time and it's like, oh my God, they're crying and they're sad and they're crying. And then it's like, oh, now we're going to cry some more. And I'm like, that's just boring. Because even when you're crying, what's the first thing you do when you stop crying? You crack a joke. That's 1,000% true. 100 times, I guarantee you. Watch, next time in real life somebody cries, the first thing they're going to do when they're done crying is crack a joke.
It's true, because, I mean, you know what I got to say is there's so many things I heard about that or I've actually witnessed where tragedy is so dark and, you know, then somebody does something, you know, says something funny that's so true that makes you laugh.
Yeah.
I'll use this as an example, but my family, we knew somebody who lost a daughter, sadly, you know, in the last few months. And it was very sad, and my mom was very supportive of them. And I think at the same – one thing that happened was, you know, you have a lot of people just – you know, you're sitting in line as people are coming up to you in the funeral and like, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And it could really ride on you.
Yeah.
And some people just want to sit there and soak and talk to you about your mourning and all this, and there's like 100 other people behind you. And I think my mom said, well, do you just want me to stand behind you and go like, okay, time to move on? And the woman goes, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And she laughed from it. And that's what you're talking about. There's this humor that we have to keep us – remind ourselves with. And I just think it just rings so true.
No, and it's so funny you say that, because whenever I write a condolence email, which they only get – you only write more of those as you get older. I never know what to say. And I've just got to the point where I just write one where I'm like, I don't know what to say. I don't have a right thing to say, but please know I'm thinking of you and I wish you the best during this difficult time. And that seemed to work for me. Because I don't want to be that person saying I'm sorry, making it worse. I don't want to rub lemon juice in the wound.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. I want to express something and show some respect and let people know I care. But you don't want to make it worse, so it's a tricky thing. So God bless your mom for doing that. What you know, John Matthews was on a little while ago. He made a documentary about his family, and now you're talking about Mumford's Law making a documentary about your family. How did you get your family to agree to that, or were they like, oh yeah, this is going to be amazing?
I can see
a lot of families being like, no way, not in 100 years.
Well, it took a while. It was not easy. You know, it really did. And the funny thing is, I think it was 19 when I asked my father. I said, hey, Dad, I want to know about your life, because his life was a mystery to me. It really was. And he laughed and he says, only when you're like 23 or whatever, or 25. And I followed him with a camera for a while, and slowly but surely his life poured out. And at the time, I was in a very bad spot. And so it was very much like therapy for me, learning his story and applying it to my own life. And at one point in the documentary, I turned the camera on myself and I started becoming part of the film. It wasn't, you know, anticipated. It just happened. And I got to really understand what it was to, you know, can a father really tell his son his truth about his past?
Yeah.
And what is the effect that happens, you know, from that? And it was, you know, it took time. It took over 5 years to really – not 5 years. I'm sorry. I actually started when I was 17, so 5 years. Yeah, it would be like, you know, I was 21, 22 when I finally finished the project.
Wow, that's remarkable. That's a brave thing to do. You know what I mean? That is a real sort of and ballsy. You know, if you don't mind me saying that word.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy asking your family these things that they haven't thought of in years, and the emotions that you're surprised that come out of them. The funny thing is, some people, it's surprising what we don't know about our own families. Sometimes we really don't. And I think that's the greatest thing to learn about is when you're actually talking to your family later on, it's so, I don't want to say entertaining, but you could relate to it so much. You could say, okay, that's why this is like this. It just, it makes sense for you. And that's what it did for me. And that's what it did for other people who saw it.
Starts clicking into place of like, oh yeah, that's why Aunt So and So.
Yeah, light bulbs start going off.
Yeah, exactly. We're gonna wrap up on Jamie Jonathan in a second, but I want to touch upon something you brought up now, and it's a remarkably important point. And I've tried to hammer this home with people at various times in my life. Some folks get it, some folks don't. I would almost say that most don't. Which is, and you know, you're being very open and honest about things. And, you know, I think as an artist, you kind of, you know, that's a good thing. Yeah. But, you know, you said at 19, you were going through a bad period of time in your life. And, when, you know, share whatever you want about that. But, like, I think it's so important. You know, you talk to a lot of writers and directors and turn around and say, have you had any bad points in your life? They're going to just nod and, you know, you're going to see the heads going up and down.
Oh, yeah.
And I think art, quite frankly, you know, whether it's therapy or not, the expression of art during those bad times, during our own personal tragedies, can at times be life-saving. And I mean to sound grand about that. I do firmly believe that sometimes being able to reach over and grab pen to paper will be the difference between somebody else who will turn around and say, you know something, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah, you really got to be truthful when it comes to art, because if you're not, you're only half asking it, and it's not, the outcome is not going to be what it is. The audience is going to read that.
Yeah,
but right away. You know, I do photography, and it's the same thing with photography. It's the same thing, you know, with writing. You know, even acting. You know, I do some acting to help my writing. And what it does is you got to be 100% in it, because if you're not, it's going to come off and the audience is going to read it. They're very good at that. You know, audience member by himself might be stupid, but if you got a whole bunch of them all together, they're a genius and they're going to read that right away.
But has it saved your soul? And I don't mean that in a super religious metaphysical way, but like, I mean, I can tell you right now, if I wasn't writing, you know, the periods of time in my life when I wasn't doing this were much darker than the periods I'm doing it now. Has it saved, you know what I mean? Have you found, like, do you ever turn around and say, my God, this film, this documentary, this script or whatever, this got me through that. This got me through that rough patch.
Yeah. Yeah. It has saved me a lot. It has opened my eyes to what I'm capable of and able to, you know, communicate to others.
And one of the things, the reason why I say that, because I've heard a few times from, like, some people who have said, and I'm not saying this in, like, a super critical, I'm not trying to pick on these people, it's just an important sort of, like, another way of looking at things, because I've heard from people say, well, you know, I'm going through a really rough patch right now, and as soon as I get through that, then I'll start writing. And I'm like, no, you're doing it the exact wrong way, you should be doing it, start writing now.
Exactly.
That is what's going to be your North Star out of this storm.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, speaking of Jamie Jonathan is talking about a life-saving movie. Again, it's about an estranged father who's driving his son to a funeral, or a father driving a failed writer,
failed writer who's driving his estranged young son to a funeral.
Wow.
Under unfortunate circumstances, and the thing is that it's his second chance to be somebody.
Yeah.
And yes, the comedy lies really in the story of that. You see him do stupid things, but he doesn't know any better because he's never been a father.
Right.
He doesn't know what it is, but he's trying. And to me, that's where the comedy is under that blankets this tragedy.
No, absolutely. And It's funny because I wrote a script last year about a failed writer, and I know a lot of writers who write about failed writers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, do you think we're trying to exercise some kind of demon with that, or like sort of confront a fear? What's your take? Like, why did you write about a failed writer?
I wrote it. I don't, you know, at one point it was going to be a failed dancer. I don't know why, but I just wrote it because writing and dyslexia, what I talked about with me, you know, being told I wasn't going to be a good writer and never would be. The character's dyslexic, and I just wanted to put it as a mirror, and it was a joke to really myself. You know, how funny is this? You know, that's really where it came from.
Do you find that Kyle C. Mumford yourself ends up in a lot of your characters?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. You have to be, even when it comes to acting, you have to be, there's something from your life personally that you have to apply to these characters because it has to be relatable to you, or else how would you write them?
No, that's absolutely true.
You know what I mean? You have to, even the dark side. I mean, you know, we all have a dark side that we don't talk about.
Not me.
No, it's just,
I'm not kidding with you, but yeah, you're absolutely right.
All those crazy thoughts that we're so afraid of thinking, wow, just like at a party, like, I hate that guy. I really want to kill him right now. Yeah. It's like, some of those things you don't really talk about, but it's funny when you do, because you'd be surprised the reactions you get when you write that pure honesty of a character.
Yeah, you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, jealousy and anger and bitterness, they end up in a lot of comedies. And we all can relate to all of those. All of those disturbing emotions, or not unhealthy emotions, I should say, not necessarily disturbing. So let's talk a bit about the Indiegogo campaign. And what's good about this too, and I don't want to bash anybody else out there. I'm not meaning this in a derogatory way, but there are a lot of campaigns out there. There's a lot of fundraising and stuff like that out there, and people are going to be, you know, should be a little discriminating sometimes, and make sure that, you know, the people you're going to give your hard-earned money to are actually going to deliver. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm glad to have you on the show, because you've delivered. We're going to put your IMDb up. You know how to make films. This film's already made. This is actually, you're raising, it's $16,000 to help finish with post-production and things of that nature.
Yeah.
And then what else, can you tell us a bit about what are you guys offering? Do you want to talk about the rewards a bit, or?
Of course. Well, what we're offering is many things. Of course, you know, from the poster, you know, signed copy of the film when it's complete. We also have things such as my compilation of my work as well that I've done in the past. One thing we are doing, this is more sort of towards, I guess, in the tri-state area, local for one of the incentives, is that we actually have one scene we want to reshoot, and you could be an extra in that scene if you want to be, and that's one of the incentives to be in there. The other thing that I think is really cool is I'm offering my services.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. Yeah,
in editing, which I'm good at, which I have the capabilities here in New York, and I could work from remote, which is easy. I also could film things. I could help you film a music video or film an event, or, you know, use my equipment, my time, my post-production skills to help finish your short film if you want. Stuff like that. And you can see all my work on my website as well. The other cool thing is that you get an invitation to the completion screening and the after party as well, and the high up as well as getting an executive producer credit. There's a lot. I mean, if you really look at the incentive list, there's a lot of jam-packed stuff. There's a play that I am in with our lead, Daniel Christian, in New York, which is in one of New York City's longest-running plays called Line. Right. You can get tickets to that. It's a really, really good show, and it's freaking hilarious. People roll out of the theater laughing. There's a lot. And it's not just the tri-state area. There's a lot more to it. If you want editing or a project, I could work with you depending on what exactly you're looking for. And I can do it here in New York, while you could be in California or Texas, that kind of thing I'm offering.
Yeah, and you guys are on a pretty good track right now. Like I said, the goal is 16, but you're at about 6 now, I think you said.
Yeah, yeah, it's about 6 right now, which is great.
That's awesome. And hey, listen, if this is something else I want to point out that I always point out with these things, because we want to talk about, one of the reasons why I want to promote these movies and stuff, because I always hate it when I go on Facebook and somebody's like, "There's no good movies out there." Yes, there is. There's a ton of great movies. There's a ton of awesome movies and a ton of awesome filmmakers who are out there making great stuff. And, maybe you have to look for them a little bit more. Maybe you have to contribute to these campaigns. But if you want great movies, they will be. They're there, I'm telling you. I mean, this is going to be a fantastic drama that's going to be funny. It's relatable. And these are the type of movies that, hey, maybe some of the big studios aren't making dramas like this, but doesn't mean you can't find them, doesn't mean you can't make them. And also, if you can't contribute, if you're listening to this right now and you're like, shoot, I'm just financially, I'm not able to contribute, well, throw out a tweet, throw out a Facebook post, throw out something out there that promotes great movies like Jami, because it's huge, because then that could get in the eyes of somebody who's like, wow, I've been waiting for a movie like this forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's one of the reasons why I want to just throw that out there. In this era of social media, that can be huge if you can't contribute. Please?
No, I was just going to say one thing in the end, with offering my services, there's many different levels if you look on the crowdfund page, but I love to make this a win-win situation. I'm not one for, crowdfunding where it's like, help me out, help me. But in a way, I like to enroll people in saying, we could help each other create something unique, helping me finish this and I could help you create a project or finish a project using my skills, my expertise. And that's what's really cool. And I don't think people have seen that really yet with this crowdfund, and I'm hoping they will.
No, that's awesome. That's outstanding. Yeah, because we're all paying it forward. We've all learned from people and all been mentored, and we're all helping and mentoring ourselves and stuff. So I think that's fantastic you're offering that.
Yeah.
Very, very generous. Last question, because I know she'll kill me if I don't bring it up. But you were actually referred to me by Shalice Belmont. How do you know the fine ladies over at Believe Entertainment?
Well,
and
I really
how awesome
know
are they?
Her. I really know her because she was a former student of a very woman who I'm very fond of and who is a saint in my life, a woman named Elizabeth Kemp. And if you know who Elizabeth Kemp is, she is one of the high-ups at the Actor Studio grad program. She's the one who's trained and still trains Bradley Cooper. And she's a very good friend. I learned so much from her, and I met Shalice from her.
Nice.
And we met one day in class, and we're just like, hey, and we just kicked it off. It was really cool that's what's so good about the indie community. Everybody – And helps out each other.
Yeah, and that ties into what you were just talking about with the editing on other projects and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so weird because this is a hyper-competitive business, I mean, you are my competition, directly, but we're all in it together.
We are.
You know what I mean? It's almost like how football players are all friends off the field, like we're all trying to win the Super Bowl, but we also all know what each other are going through and know that we can't do it without each other.
Yeah.
I know that sounds kind of – I know people might roll their eyes and say, oh, that sounds really saccharine and all that. But it's honestly 100% true. Nobody does it on their own.
Exactly. It is very true.
So rock and roll. So thank you, Shalice, as always. And Kyle C. Mumford, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough. This was a blast.
Thank you so much. I mean, I really appreciate it. I mean, for those out there, go check out the page on Indiegogo, Jamie and Jonathan short film. It's great. Thank you, Tim, so much for having me.
No, my pleasure. And hey, when it comes out, you have to come back on and we'll talk about your next movie.
Awesome.
And
I would love to do that.
We'll keep kicking some ass and bring some more Jersey pride to the internet. So, and we got some very cool – very cool indie filmmakers coming up over the next few weeks. It's a great time. It really is. I think we're entering a golden age of independent cinema. And I'm so psyched to be talking to you guys and about all this stuff. So – it is an absolute blast. And I hope everybody had an absolute blast listening. Thanks for sharing, retweeting, downloading. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.